The road that has no end. How we traded our ordinary lives for a global bicycle touring adventure by Tim Travis. Tim and Cindy Travis have been traveling by bicycle since 2002 with no plans to stop. As you hear this, they are probably on the road. All of the pictures from this book and their current location can be found at www.downtheroad.org. Chapter 1. Leaving It All Behind. Travelers call the road home, and our home is a road that has no end. Travelers wake to an itch, a need to trade the weight of material possessions, creature comforts, and security for what is unknown, often uncomfortable, and sometimes dangerous. In exchange, they experience new cultures, see beautiful places the world has to offer, and learn about themselves in the process. The trade is well worth it. As you read this, I'm probably on the road. I began my obsession with traveling in grade school. My father returned from a business trip in Germany with a wall map of Europe. I found it alluring that the map was entirely in the German language. My imagination was sparked. Maps, globes, and world atlases mesmerized me. I scoured my middle school library looking for books about distant countries and cultures. I can remember playing a game at the library. I would spin the globe and shut my eyes. Then I would stop it with my finger and see what country I had randomly selected. Next, I would look the country up in the encyclopedia and search for all of the books that I could find about it. Soon the answers I was looking for were not to be found in Indiana. The cornfields of Indiana can be a long way from anything. Little did I know that someday I would be riding my bicycle through remote villages in Guatemala or discussing politics with impoverished farmers in Nicaragua. Patience is essential for a traveling man. Background. Born in 1966, I grew up in Greenwood, Indiana, in a good home with two loving parents. I found my calling at the age of 11 when I became a cyclist. My parents were wise to nurture this instinct in me. I firmly believe that my involvement in cycling kept me out of serious trouble. I started riding bicycles in the mid-1970s with a campy 5-speed bike, wool shorts, and one of those funny leather helmets that cyclists wore back then. The bicycle racing movie, Breaking Away, hit theaters and I quickly fell into racing. I was immersed in racing until I graduated from Indiana University in 1991 with a bachelor's degree in physical education. Competing on a bicycle taught me many things, including riding techniques and mechanical skills that I now use in my daily life on the road. More importantly, racing taught me how far I could push myself physically. This foundation prepared me for a future full of biking in foul weather and endless mountain climbs. Once I finished with undergraduate school, I was free to roam. I left Indiana permanently and headed west. I traveled by bicycle and worked in several different states in the western U.S. I existed on the least amount of money possible. I drifted around looking for work in each town, saved up a little money, and moved on. This may sound romantic, but in reality, it was difficult. This kind of living can exhaust even a young man. I learned the ropes of basic survival and hard living. Looking ragged and being treated as an outcast taught me much about society. Many people looked down on me because I looked poor. They did not judge me on my actions, but the way I looked. A few people didn't notice my appearance and saw me as an equal. This served as a strong reminder of a value I had always known. Avoid bias based on appearances. I settled in Arizona, where the climate and mountains suited me. I lived in Prescott for 10 years, except for 2 years of graduate school at Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff. It was at NAU that I met Cindy's twin sister Sherry and husband Scott. They introduced me to Cindy, who was living in New Mexico at the time. Cindy was energetic and loved the outdoors. She was born in 1961 and grew up on the East Coast. Cindy had previously attended NAU and finished with a Bachelor of Science in Geology in 1984. She was working as a geologist in Albuquerque when I met her. Cindy and I had a two-wheeled romance. When I met Cindy, she owned a mountain bike. Our first date was a mountain bike ride in Flagstaff. During this date, she crashed and bruised her knee badly. I helped her up and put her back on her bike. I wondered if she would finish out our ride or go home crying. She thought about quitting for a moment, but instead finished the ride. Years later, Cindy told me that this was a tender moment for her and explained that when I comforted her, I encouraged her to do what she had previously thought impossible. This was a defining moment in our relationship for both of us. Early in our relationship, I took Cindy on her first bike tour around the Yucatan Peninsula in southern Mexico. I took the cheap way down, riding a bus to Cancun, and met Cindy in the airport well after dark. I unpacked her bike and assembled it. She asked if we were going to one of the famous beaches. She was excited to have a romantic getaway. I've never liked touristy beach resorts, and told her that we were going in the opposite direction. Cancun is only an airport to me. She asked where we were staying for the night. I answered, "I will figure that out when we get there." She nervously followed me into the Mexican darkness. She must have trusted me a lot to have done this. We found a construction site and set the tent up. In the morning, we met friendly Mexican workers and over a long conversation shared our coffee. She saw that traveling could be more than glitzy beach resorts. A few months later, she bought a used road bike. She learned to draft and ride pace lines on the roads of New Mexico. I saw a lot of potential in her as a cyclist. After the trip to Mexico, I bought the first motor vehicle I had owned in 5 years, a 24-foot 1976 Ford recreational vehicle that leaked 5 different colors of fluids and burned $10 in gasoline for every hour driven. It was old when I bought it and literally falling apart when I sold it years later. I had 2 repair manuals and learned how to keep it working more or less. The RV would play an unexpected but important role in making my dreams come true in the future. When I finished graduate school, I moved out of my apartment in Flagstaff and permanently into my RV. I was detached from the earth, living mobile and rent-free. I could have gone anywhere I liked, but I returned to Prescott, Arizona. To this day, I think of it as a nearly perfect place for a cyclist to live. It has great weather, endless mountain bike trails, and challenging road rides. My RV was fully self-contained, including a hot shower and refrigerator. I set it up so I could park free and ride my bicycle for transportation, including to and from work. Cindy was able to find a good job in a geologic consulting firm in Prescott and moved into the RV with me. This lasted several months, but eventually we rented a house. Back then, we owned many possessions and had trouble fitting them into this small space. We continued using the RV for weekend getaways. In the winter, we would go to Phoenix and participate in group bicycle rides. In the summer, we would go to Flagstaff and mountain bike in the cool mountain temperatures. Everything changed when Cindy wanted to buy a tandem bicycle built for two with me. I knew as a lifelong cyclist that this was the ultimate sign of commitment. Wedding rings are liquid. They can be bought and sold easily. Tandem bicycles are individual machines that fit 2 specific people in terms of 2 sizes, style, and color. I am 6'4" tall, which is 1.93 meters, and Cindy is 5'7" tall, which is 1.7 meters. Tandem bikes can also be quite expensive. For these reasons, it takes months of planning to buy one. A tandem is nearly impossible to sell. Where would you find 2 people of the same height and bicycle preferences? Buying a tandem bicycle means 2 people plan on riding together for life. The idea of marriage comes to each of us in its own unique way. Strangely enough, this was how it started to form for me. I knew that it was time to ask her to marry me. I proposed during a bike ride. I simply pulled up next to her and asked, "Will you marry me?" We were married in a Las Vegas drive-thru called the Tunnel of Love. We rode up on single bikes, the Justice of the Peace spoke, and we switched to our tandem and rode away. We have been joined in this symbolic way ever since. We don't have to be on the same bike to be connected. We spent our honeymoon in the Seattle, Washington area, touring on our tandem. We enjoyed 3 weeks of good weather while camping and riding our loaded bike. The seeds of an epic journey were planted while we casually drifted past the incredible scenery. Neither of us wanted it to end. We talked unceasingly about what it would be like to keep going. First, we had to go back to Prescott and resume our normal lives. We bought a house and settled into our jobs and daily routines. Cindy continued her work as a geologist, and I worked as a special education teacher in a local school. After a short time, the road would be whispering in my ear again. 5 years before we left. Occasionally, I would say to Cindy, "What if we left and bike toured until retirement?" At this point, we didn't have the necessary funds, so the whole concept seemed unrealistic. Time would work this dream into a reality, but it took baby steps. We were already saving money. Our original goal was to save enough to pay cash for a new truck. This was logical because Cindy used her 4-wheel drive truck for work. She was always going to remote locations on sketchy roads. Our thinking was that it was only a matter of time before age rendered her truck undependable. When the time came to replace it, we didn't want to go into debt. Saving money made sense to both of us, but I was thinking of something better than a truck. I always had the dream of seeing the world, and that requires money. We worked out how much we were earning and our expenses. The difference was surprising. We were amazed at how cheaply we could live. Cindy calculated a monthly budget to pay our mortgage and other essential expenses. She then added enough money so that we could be comfortable and have small extras. She calculated that if we could tighten the belt a little more, we could live on 25% of our income. The remaining 75% could be saved every month. We stuck to this budget for 5 years. In fact, whenever we received pay raises, we didn't increase our living budget, but instead increased the percentage of our saving. Our secret to being able to save this aggressively was simple. We cut out the big-ticket items that other couples with similar incomes were buying on credit. We never made car or credit card payments. The only debt that we allowed was the mortgage for the house. We had purchased a 1,000-square-foot, 2-bedroom house that was half of what we could afford. We were approved for a mortgage that would have put us into financial bondage. We had no use for a showy house with 3,000-square-foot of living area. The payments would have been a substantial percentage of our income. That wasn't our American dream. After about 30 months, we reached our original savings goal of $30,000. Now we needed to decide what to do with the money. We could buy a flashy 4-wheel drive that would be the envy of the neighborhood. We could buy many tempting toys that are essential in American culture to announce success. I kept thinking that this money could be used for something more. I told Cindy that we could use this money to travel for 2 or 3 years. She didn't believe me. Cindy had traveled to numerous countries before I met her. Her previous traveling experiences to Europe, Asia, and New Zealand had always been more expensive. We compromised. We had our old truck painted and tuned up instead of buying a new one. Keeping our growing savings in the bank kept our options open. This was my first sign that Cindy was considering my dream to travel. I started telling all of our friends that Cindy and I were going on a multi-year, around-the-world bike tour. I even speculated the month and year that we were leaving. They would turn to Cindy and ask her for confirmation. Cindy said, "This is Tim's dream. It's good for Tim to dream, but we have a house and careers here." I felt on my own. This didn't stop me from talking about my dream all the time. I'm sure that I annoyed many people. I couldn't help it. The idea burned inside of me. I thought that the more I talked about it, the more likely it would actually happen. I thought of it as a self-fulfilling prophecy. Leaving it all behind doesn't sound so romantic when you are the one risking everything. Cindy liked the idea of saving money and traveling. The thought of living in a tent and completely changing our lifestyle was difficult for her to accept at first. I worked the idea into her head slowly but steadily. There were a few facts on my side. Cindy has a passion for travel. She previously had traveled by bus through numerous countries. She wanted more. She, like many Americans, was also tired of working long hours at her job. My big dream tempted her because it offered more to life. My idea promised freedom itself. I bought every book I could find about people who had previously ridden around the world on bicycles. I made sure these books were visible in our house. Cindy, who is an avid reader, eventually read a few of them. By reading these books, she learned that such trips are possible. I needed a tool to push her into commitment. I was getting close. For most people, like Cindy, thinking and planning several years in advance is difficult. I needed a tangible way of showing her that we were making progress in reaching a start date. I made a calendar on our computer. It had 32 pages representing the number of months until the date we left. Every page had a large number at the top. The first page started with 32 and counted down every month until it reached 1. This represented the last month before we left. Instead of a random picture for decoration, I had a map of a different country every month. Under each map, I put information about the weather and the best time to visit each country. For example, the month of December had a map of Guatemala and said something like, "The dry season is from November to May. Weather-wise, this is the most pleasant time to travel in Guatemala." These countries didn't flow in order, but instead randomly jumped around the globe to build excitement. At first, Cindy didn't think much of my calendar. 32 pages felt thick, and the number of months still looked like a long time to wait. I hung it up in our house and it became a working calendar. We wrote various appointments and activities on the corresponding dates and consulted it often. As time went by, the numbers decreased and the stack of paper became thinner. Tearing a page off every month took on a special meaning. I think that this tactile and visual reminder of time passing was powerful. 2 years before we left. During the last 2 years, I started an extensive study of the world. I bought dozens of travel guidebooks. I always had several with me wherever I went. Friends and coworkers would become suspicious when they saw books and maps for China, Africa, and Europe with me at the same time. I first read the important preliminary facts about weather, visa requirements, and cost. After I gained a general idea of each region, I looked up specific places and tried to imagine what it would be like for us to be arriving on loaded bicycles. Where would we sleep, eat, and use a bank card? Soon my desk was completely covered with maps and books. I felt as if I was back in middle school, looking at the world atlas and dreaming of a world that was so far away. This time, it was much more fun. Now, it could actually happen. The internet held the most useful information. I found dozens of websites made by others who were riding in every country of the world. Reading their stories about cycling adventures taught me what to expect. I learned to adjust my expectations of life on the road. The most elusive piece of the puzzle was trying to determine how much it was going to cost. I wanted to estimate how far our money would take us. This was frustrating because bicycle touring websites and books do not disclose detailed information about cost. The budgets suggested in the guidebooks are high. Guidebooks are designed for short-term tourists traveling by bus. The budget in the guidebooks factor in the cost of lodging and bus tickets. We planned on camping often and riding our bikes. I felt that we could go much cheaper, but Cindy wasn't as sure. This was truly the great unknown, and therefore was a source of fear. After much research and debate, Cindy and I finally settled on an annual budget of $15,000, or about $41 a day for the two of us. Next, we divided our expected savings by this estimated budget and came up with 7 years. The cost of equipment was much higher than expected, which prevented us from making our savings goal. We bought high-quality equipment. Our bicycles cost over $4,000 combined. The laptop computer and digital camera cost over $4,000 combined. Panniers for both bikes cost over $1,000. Tent, water filter, and camp stove cost over $1,000 combined. And bike and travel clothing cost over $1,000 combined. In total, we spent over $11,000 on equipment the first year. We originally budgeted $6,000 for equipment. If our travel budget was off by this much, our plans could have derailed. Luckily, the daily cost of traveling turned out to be less than our original annual estimate of $15,000. We went over our equipment budget by $5,000, but we ended up under our travel budget by $5,000. Therefore, we remained close to our budget for the first year. Once we had settled on 7 years, I started piecing our trip together. Nothing in my life felt more exciting than looking at a world map and working out how much of it my wife and I would see in 7 years. Our route was based on cost effectiveness, avoiding burnout, and weather patterns. The cost effectiveness boiled down to limiting flights and seeking cheaper countries. I knew from my research that travelers' burnout is a real problem for those on multi-year trips. To avoid this, I scheduled extra amounts of time for each area so we would never feel rushed. I also had the idea that we would mix difficult, underdeveloped countries with developed, comfortable countries. These strategies would keep our living standards changing enough to renew our interest and keep us fresh. Paying attention to weather patterns is important in bicycle touring and the most difficult part of the planning process. This is where my calendar with weather came in handy. I came up with a plan that would follow the best weather around the globe. 1 year before we left. Our homemade calendar had shrunk to a dozen pieces of paper. We were down to the final year. The Big 12 highlighted on the top couldn't be avoided. This short amount of time pushed the issue of commitment. If we were actually going to go through with our plan, several critical tasks had to be completed. Accomplishing these tasks would require commitment from Cindy and push us past the point of no return. We had to sell or box for storage everything we owned, except what we could carry on two bicycles. In addition, we had to move out and rent our house, switch bank accounts, and cancel insurance policies. My discreet persuasion and patience was put to the test. Previously, Cindy's first reason for not going was the lack of funds. Now the numbers in our bank account looked good, and she knew that we could reach our savings goal of $105,000 within 12 more months. This caused the true fears inside of her to surface. Completely letting go of the security and comfort of her current lifestyle was staring her in the face. Everything she was used to would be left behind. I'm not exactly sure when she decided to commit fully. It was gradual. Nevertheless, I was happy when she told me she was ready to quit her job and go. She later confessed that she wanted to go on the trip while she was still willing to camp and sleep on the ground. Once she was committed, she never looked back. She isn't a quitter. Now that we have been on the road for several years, it would be impossible to talk her out of it. She is also married to the road, a true rambling woman. I formulated the escape plan. I truly thought of it as an escape plan because it seemed as if everyone and everything was trying to prevent us from living out our dream. Our friends outside work told us that we were crazy and tried to convince us to keep our careers. I knew that they were only looking out for our best interests. They still didn't think we were serious. We were alone. Going from living in a house with a car to living in a tent with a bicycle is an incredibly difficult thing to do. Whenever people ask us what has been the hardest part of our global bicycle adventure, we answer, pedaling out of our driveway. It was easy to save money compared to working out all the details of moving to our new lifestyle. This wasn't only a vacation where we had to arrange to have our mail held and plants watered. This involved things like juggling our time with ending our jobs, selling our cars and painting the house. I came up with a plan that would eventually leave us with only a tent to call home. I feared that this extreme change would be a huge jolt to our mental health. We needed a transitional lifestyle that wasn't yet on the bikes, but with fewer comforts than living in our house. Besides, we had a lot of work to do on the house to prepare it for renters. We wanted renters before we left, so we couldn't stay in our house until the day we left on our bikes. I decided that we would move back into our old and rickety RV as a temporary step between worlds. This was the key to solving the problem. We started the long process of moving out of the house by having a big garage sale. This wasn't an ordinary garage sale. We were selling almost everything we owned. Things that seemed essential now felt like anchors holding us down. We questioned why we had a toaster we never used. We had pots that didn't have lids, clothes that were too small, and enough extra sheets to supply a small motel. We emptied everything out of the house in 2 days. Basic essentials and work clothes were set up in the RV, and the rest was placed on the driveway to sell. The prices were ridiculously low. Everything had to go in one short weekend. This drew hordes of people. They were sifting through our things and buying all our possessions. Our friends and neighbors were concerned. This was the first concrete evidence that we had lost our minds and were serious about leaving. They pleaded with us to think hard and reconsider. We were thinking, but not the same way they were. Cindy cried after watching her beloved houseplants, dress shoes, crockpot, and other favorite trinkets vanish from her life. These things must have seemed irreplaceable to her. I had a different outlook on the matter. I felt relieved to lighten the load. We were moving in the right direction. I comforted Cindy, telling her that we could always buy new things, but that traveling the world was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Our lives were forever going to be different. It was like taking a giant leap in the dark and hoping to land in a good place. Finally, everything was sold or given to charity. The last item out of the house was our bed, marking the final conversion to RV living. We stayed parked in the driveway while we prepared our empty house for renters. We cleaned and painted every day after work for a month. Once the house was ready, we had several property management companies come by and look at it. This was nerve-wracking. We weren't sure how much monthly rent we could collect. We needed enough to cover the mortgage, 10% property management fees, insurance, and a little left over to pay for occasional repairs. We both knew that if we couldn't rent our house for a substantial amount of money, that we would have to sell it. I wanted to find a way of keeping our house. I knew from traveling in the past that it's hard not to have a place that I can call home and theoretically return. Most of the property managers told us that our house wouldn't be worth enough in monthly rent to cover our expenses. One company liked our house and believed that it was marketable. They told us that it would be easy to collect enough rent to cover our expenses. We signed a contract, and they took over. Signing the contract with the property management company meant that we had to move our RV permanently from the driveway. I was teaching at a remote residential school. We parked the RV a few miles from the school. This worked out well in several ways. I was close enough to my job so that I could ride my bike. Besides building my fitness, I was now able to sell my car. Cindy still needed her truck to go to her job. We knew that we would have to sell it at the last possible minute. We never worried about selling the RV because it was disposable. I knew as a last resort that I could always drive it to a junkyard the day before we left. The other advantage to living in our small RV was that it was free. Our house was now rented and paying for itself. We were still working and could save the money that we normally sent to the mortgage. We did this for several months. We had been researching touring bikes, travel clothing, and camping gear for months. Now that the big job of selling our things and moving out of the house was complete, we were ready to make final decisions and buy equipment. We bought all of our equipment, such as a tent, bike clothing, and camp stove, on the internet and sent it to Cindy's work address. 2 months before we left, while we were living in the RV and buying equipment, we had been keeping our plans hidden from people at our workplaces. Soon, however, boxes were arriving almost daily at Cindy's office because that was now the only physical address we had, and her coworkers were growing suspicious. My principal and coworkers were confused when I started showing up to work on my mountain bike. They knew that the school was a 45-minute drive from my house. What they didn't know was that we were living in the RV a few miles from the school. When questioned, I told them that I was trying to get back in shape. Rumors were flying around at both our workplaces. I could only imagine what people were dreaming up to explain things they didn't understand. 2 months before we left, we both submitted resignation letters to our supervisors. I wrote a brief memo announcing when my last day of work would be and that I was quitting because I was leaving on a 7-year around-the-world bike tour. They initially were skeptical. They could not believe that my wild story was true. When Cindy gave notice, her boss took the news better than she expected. He was supportive and helped make the final days of leaving smoother. Telling all of our friends was much easier than those at our jobs because I had been hinting to them that we were leaving for years. We wrote a group email that was sent to over 300 friends and both our families. This letter also committed us to leaving on a specific date. The letter told the world when and where we were going to break free and start living out our dreams. The plan. Our letter. We plan to spend the first 4 weeks meandering around southern Arizona to get our legs strong and break in the gear. Around May 1st, 2002, we will cross the U.S.-Mexican border at Douglas and begin the many climbs into the central Mexico highlands. Around July or so, we want to spend a few weeks going to a Spanish immersion school in Guanajuato, Mexico. The famous Velodrome bicycle racetrack, where Eddie Merckx set the hour record, is on our list as well. Around October 2002, we will descend out of the central highlands of Mexico and cross the Guatemalan border in late November 2002. We will spend about 5 months in Central America, riding through Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, Nicaragua, and Costa Rica, until we arrive in Panama around April 2003. At this time, we plan to visit my family in Indiana and Cindy's family in Connecticut for a month. After our time in the States, we hope to continue either in Colombia or Ecuador around June 2003. Colombia is a great bike country, but not the kind of place you want to visit in a bad year. If all goes well, we will follow the spine of the Andes Mountains south all the way to southern Chile. We haven't decided whether we want to go all the way to the tip of Tierra del Fuego or not. But around March 2004, we plan on flying to Africa to spend several months riding in the more friendly countries, not in civil war, of that continent. After Africa, we think that we may want to teach English in Europe, maybe southern Spain or Greece in September 2004. Athens for the 2004 Summer Olympics may be a possibility too. Besides teaching English, we would like to travel around Europe for a year. I'm sure we will have to catch a major portion of the Tour de France, or we will surely feel like we came to dinner but never really ate. Things get very sketchy after that, but I can see us flying from Europe to Hong Kong and riding several months in China and eventually meandering south through Asia until we get to Australia. Australia will take about a year to explore. Heading to New Zealand is a requirement that I must accomplish in order to satisfy an agreement that I made with Cindy. You have no idea what other things I had to agree to before she would go on this trip. But she's my trooper and worth every effort. Come join us. We leave Saturday, March 30th, 2002. We will have breakfast at the Tecate Grill in downtown Prescott at around 8 a.m. We will be leaving on our adventure from the Prescott Courthouse at 9:30 a.m. I would like to invite anyone who wants to see us off to meet us for breakfast at the Tecate Grill and or at the Prescott Courthouse to ride with us one last time. I know that this will be impossible for the many out-of-state recipients of this email, and we will have to catch up with you later. For the rest, we would like one last grind up the white spars together, or at least coffee. We will update our webpage, www.downtheroad.org, when we can. The site is started, but is a shell at this point, and will have more content as we travel down the road. We are starting a new email list in order to stay in contact with everyone. If you would like to remain on this list, please reply to this email. Don't be afraid to write. Tim and Cindy Travis. The reaction this created was overwhelming. Emotions ran the spectrum from panic to enthusiastic approval. The week before we left. Cindy had stopped working for 2 weeks before our departure date to visit her twin sister in Alaska. She sold her truck before she left. I stopped working a week before we left and spent time fishing with my brother who came out from Indiana. I needed a place to stay until the last moment while Cindy was in Alaska with her twin sister. I worked out a deal with someone to buy the RV and pick it up the day before our departure. I sold it for a mere $500. This may not sound like much for a RV, but it was more than I expected. It was a much better deal than the $50 that the junk man would have given me for it. Moving out of our RV was a big job, but much easier than moving out of the house. Everything was on a smaller scale. 2 nights before we left, I unloaded the RV in front of Cindy's office. The entire contents of our RV went into 3 different piles to be loaded up on our bikes, to go to charity, to the dumpster. I stayed up the entire night to complete this in time for the buyer to pick up the RV at the agreed time. The last thing I removed was my homemade calendar. It was only a single piece of paper now. I sat down and contemplated what this final page meant to me. I had made this calendar almost 3 years before and patiently waited for this moment. We had sacrificed and saved all this time. I no longer needed my calendar. Time was up. I had won the waiting game. I slowly folded it into a paper airplane and threw it to freedom. It was my own private victory celebration. After Cindy returned from Alaska, we no longer owned motor vehicles. Standing in Cindy's office, we both noticed that we didn't have any keys on our key rings. The key to our house was now with the property manager. Our work keys were returned, and the car keys were given to the new owners. It was a strange feeling. We were free of this expense and responsibility. We were now down to the bare minimum. The night before we left. The night before we left was filled with one last job to be completed before we earned our freedom. We had to take the pile of gear and food on the floor of Cindy's office and somehow load it on our 2 bicycles. This required me to stay up for my 2nd all-nighter in a row. Even though we had prepared and planned for years, we still felt as if we weren't ready. It was the first time that we completely packed our bikes. It quickly became evident that not everything on the floor could come along. We were asking ourselves what we could spend the next several years without. We asked each other, "Is this all I get to cook with? Do you think I can live with fewer clothes?" The amount of non-perishable food that had come out of the RV was staggering. We had fallen short of eating the canned food, such as peas and soup. We came up with a quick solution to deal with it. We had it mailed to a town in Arizona, Portal, near the Mexican border. As one last going-away gift, Cindy's boss picked up the tab for mailing the boxes to us. We planned to pick it up in several weeks. Even though we stayed up all night, we had to rush at the end. The last hour was spent frantically cramming gear into our bags and indiscriminately tying things onto rear racks. We looked like amateurs.